Hi guys, this is Veronica Jacobson from Richfield, Minnesota, and I wanted to comment on the question sent out today about whether or not it's better to go with a group or go it alone. And it sounds wonderful. Stand up, stand up, stand up for what you believe in. I am all for being an individual, but oh my God, you don't get anything done if you stand around and complain. But no one knows how to work together anymore. All I hear is me, me, me. And that doesn't get anything done. We have to work together. And if that means sacrificing what you believe in on a small part to work as a group, then so be it. The time for complaining is done. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you. Bye.
Hey there, Jeff Horwich. This is In the Loop, of course. Just a little something that rolled in off the ITL voicemail this week. Kind of a Rodney King 2010, maybe. Can't we all just get along? The context Veronica's reacting to is Nancy Pelosi promising to line up the troops and force through the health reform bill. That's still undecided as I speak to you at this moment. Veronica's clearly exasperated, as I think so many of us are, by this bickering, point-scoring, all-or-nothing political climate we've got going. And it's bordering on not funny anymore, really. So, thank goodness for Senator Jim Bunning for coming along and giving me an easy target this week. That's coming up later, along with Sandin trying to justify why the recession is good for our health. We're going to talk with a guy who just started a website that lets you rate your church. And we have a singer named Heather Lynn who's coming into the studio. She's going to be our fifth and final starving artist interview. And this episode also contains an announcement about our show. No need to be coy about it. We don't play games with you guys, and you deserve to hear it first. In the Loop is ending, and this is going to be one of our last ones. I'm sorry about that, of course. I'm not going to wade into the details here because we do have a great episode lined up. Rest assured, we still had fun this week, but I also didn't see the point in being cute about it and just dropping a bomb on you at the end of the show. So there you go. Maybe I'll share a few more thoughts before we wrap up, but it is what it is. And our problems, really, are nothing compared to, say, an 8.8 magnitude earthquake. How's that for a segue? Today they're saying it might take 4 years to rebuild parts of Chile. In situations like this, of course, we go digging through our public insight network, our connections and sources around the world to see who we might know in that neck of the woods. And on the other end of a kind of scratchy phone line, I understand, we found Father Maurice Alvarado. He's a Catholic priest in Valparaiso, which is kind of in the center of the country, a ways north of the quake's biggest impact. But he seemed like a thoughtful guy, and he knows a heck of a lot more about it than I do, so we called him up. Father, thank you very much for taking some time for our show.
Thanks for having me.
So even though the buildings are standing around you and people's homes are safe and most of the deaths and injuries are in the south, do you feel this as a peculiarly sort of national crisis?
Yeah, it is pretty much a very big national crisis for us. We kind of take pride in being very united in these kinds of catastrophes. Hmm. There's a lot of different reactions, but people overreact, and there's still a lot of aftershocks. So many people kind of a bit uneasy on one side.
I think you mentioned that there has been some overreaction.
Yeah, a lot of like kind of mass hysteria and kind of stuff like that, or people, you know, just very, very nervous. For example, people, you know, going to supermarkets and just trying to buy everything. Well, like all these, how do you call this, when they raid the supermarkets.
Looting.
Stores. Yeah, looting and all that.
I want to ask you about that because I don't know a ton about Chile. I've never been there, but I think of it as a pretty modern first world country. And we're hearing a lot about looting, and I'm just wondering what's up with that.
Yeah, that's one of the things shocks us most, more than the earthquake. It's they speak about here about a moral quake or something.
A moral quake?
Yeah, because we know Chilean people, we like to take advantage of situations and stuff, but this is just like too much.
Do you have any theories about why people are taking advantage, as you say, you know, in that way in the South? Something in the culture?
Yeah, it's kind of like cultural things. And many Chileans living in Europe, for example, are known for being, you know, really good robbers and thieves and stuff like that. So, yeah.
I wasn't aware of that reputation.
No, yeah.
But you're
it's a bad
so.
Reputation we have. have in some places. We were aware of it, but we never thought it was so much.
And now you're seeing it.
Yeah, we're seeing it, and it's very strange. I don't think anybody really knows why this is happening.
Do you get the sense that the rest of the world is responding to help out? Does Chile need our help, or can they take care of themselves here?
Well, any help is well received, but I think Chile has a very strong economy, and I think that our people are very charitable. As a church, we have a lot of organizations working side by side with many corporations and companies and stores, along with governments.
And you have a telethon coming up, right, or something like that? Is it like what we do here, where all the celebrities come out and sing
exactly,
songs?
Yeah, exactly, like what Jerry Lewis used to do back then.
George Clooney is not involved?
George Clooney? I have no idea.
George Clooney is an American actor who seems, seems to be at the forefront of every telethon-type effort whenever a natural disaster comes along.
No, we got our own telethon. We don't need George Clooney.
Well, Padre, thank you very much for giving us some additional perspective on what's happening there.
Thank you for having me.
And I wish you luck with your relief work that I know you're doing.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
That's Father Maurice Alvarado. He's a Catholic priest in Valparaiso, Chile. From one church story to another, I guess. I imagine most of you have probably heard of Yelp, and you know how Yelp works. Well, one of our listeners, our friend Robert Fisher, has been pitching us on this idea, saying we really needed to check out a new website that a friend of his was building called churchraider.com. And I guess you can kind of think of it like a Yelp for churches. It's a little more complicated than that, but you can imagine why that might be controversial or interesting at the very least. So we asked the guy who's running the site, his name is Tyler Mahoney, to come and talk to me about it for a few minutes. Tyler, thanks very much.
Hey, thanks, Jeff, for having me on.
Tyler's a grad student at the Divinity School at my alma mater, Duke University, and he's headed over to Chapel Hill to get to a nice fancy microphone to talk to me today. So just give me the basics of how it works.
Well, yeah, the essence of it is you can go on and you can post a review or a rating on a church. It's similar to Yelp in that way, where you do have this more social media aspect. But at the same time, what we're doing is we want to actually have a conversation with people, too.
And people can give a church a rating, 1 to 5 stars, right?
Yes, they can give a church a rating. But we do say, you know, you can't just walk around, you can't just walk away and say, great, and then five stars and a sentence. We do a 25-word minimum, and if we don't think your review's enough, we're going to call you out. We're going to go, hey, you know, this, you've literally given me no real information on this church. If I was an outsider looking for a church in your area, your review would not tell me what your ads are actually about.
What kind of criteria should people be using to rate and review a church?
That is a very loaded question in itself. Is it a consumeristic model? Like, how good was the music? Or was the preacher, did he sound good like Tony Robbins? Or was the music better than you two? I'll give you two really quick examples. One of them is that people do go on and think of it, you know, it was great preaching. It was really Bible-based. You know, that's one rating that you're going to. Another rating is, does anyone even notice I'm here? That's a criteria I've seen. No one shook my hand. You know, who talked to me? You know, I'm sitting alone in the back of a church. You know, who's going to come up and speak to me? They want to focus on community. That's one of the biggest one I'm getting, is that there's real community here.
Now, you do have people from the churches, and in some cases, elders, deacons, whatever, who are posting about how great their church is. But you also have plenty of negative reviews. And the churches that get reviewed, any church can go up on that list, right? They must not like this, all of them.
Yes. But you know what? When I get a paper back as a graduate student and I get an 89, you know, I want little notes on why I got an 89. Don't just hand me a grade. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's why we do encourage people to kind of, you know, elongate their review. Do a critique. Tell us what they could do better.
I spent a little bit of time with it earlier today. I just want to go through a couple of these responses that that struck me as, I don't know, interesting in various ways. I think they gave this 4 stars, but they said, the low mark for singing is my honest personal opinion. I'm sure most of our members find the singing very uplifting. Obviously, God is concerned with what's in the heart, not what comes out of the mouth. And I'm sure God is pleased with the singing at Northern Light Church of Christ. I got a kick out of that one. People do comment on the quality of the singing quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. If music and worship is very important to you, you're going to get people to talk about that. And since music is a big focus of church, of course, it's going to be a big one that we talk about.
Here's one from a church in Maryland that was a little bit worrying. This is the 1-star review. Intentionally strong community is formed in small groups where I found trained leaders to exercise a great amount of authority over participants. Both myself and my friends had painful experiences with this church. Some found it nearly impossible to leave. That sounds like a cult.
Yeah, that's a really big thing now that we have to worry, especially college campuses are getting really wise to this too, they've noticed.
This is a great tool in a way. Then you just imagine somebody being able to look it up and not get caught up in a cult.
Yeah, exactly. Please avoid. You know what I mean? You know, mm-hmm. those kind of things. It's really important because that can be extremely damaging in your Christian walk to live in that kind of manipulation. And I would love for people to avoid that.
Here's one from your neck of the woods. This is in Raleigh, North Carolina. Let's see. Music ministry is phenomenal. This is a 3-star review, by the way. On any given Sunday, you'll find a great liturgical dance team. Pastor's a great speaker, but falls short when he adds too many cliches. And then you read ahead and it says, also, beware of offering requests exceeding $1,000 per person to fuel pastors' personal projects like studios, home in Florida, and expensive trips to Mexico to get stem cell knee injection.
Uh-huh.
That's a 3-star review?
Hey, you know, it's happening. I mean, there are certain traditions out there, including my own as a Roman Catholic, you know, where money isn't spent that wisely. But, no, I think sometimes, you know, things should like that come out. You know, what am I giving money to, almost what seems to be a business? Or am I giving money to the church, to the body of Christ?
Or are you giving it to the body of the pastor?
Exactly.
To get stem cell injections in his knees.
Exactly. And I'm all for pastors having health insurance. Trust me, I'm getting an MDiv. I'm going to need health insurance. But at the same time, people need to know.
But by taking churches and allowing people to use the tool to essentially treat them like a Starbucks, you know, and rate it and review it based on whatever strikes their fancy, aren't you commercializing the notion of going to church, turning people into consumers instead of believers? And do you care if you're doing that?
Oh, I care. I care very, very much about the consumerization of church. The church is consumeristic now. It is. And we just kind of have to deal with that reality. I'm going to direct as much as I can to help people, you know, and want them to understand that, you know what, man, we don't need to be doing the consumeristic model anymore. And that's the thing people don't understand when they come at me with, you're contributing to the consumerization of church. I go, whoa. ChurchRater is a democratic tool. You can use ChurchRater to stop the consumerization of the church, or you can just ignore it and say it's consumeristic.
Are you going to spin off into Mosque Raider, Temple Raider, I don't know, Synagogue Raider?
We're probably going to do a Shul Raider here pretty soon for synagogues. I don't feel comfortable doing Mosque Raider because we don't actually have a Muslim on our team. We do have a Jew, but ethically for Mosque Raider, I wouldn't feel comfortable as a Christian trying to relate another religion. I think that would be rude and inconsiderate.
But your personal inspiration for starting this was rooted in your questions about Christianity especially. Right,
oh, yeah.
How this might get at that. So is this a peculiarly Christian issue right now, you think, where rating could really be effective in helping to distinguish the churches?
I think it very much can be. We could get a lot of feedback, and I think that's really important. As a church, I think we've lost our mission statement. Our mission statement is not stop abortion and stop gay marriage, as much as people may have believed that in America. Uh-huh. Our mission statement is love God and love your neighbor as yourself. That's the mission statement. And I feel like we've lost that. And so, yes, you know, that's part of my goal out of this whole project.
Thanks very much for taking some time to explain it to us.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
That's Tyler Mahoney. He's a graduate student at the Divinity School at Duke University, and he runs Church Raider. That's Raider with a T, not a D, churchraider.com. So remember our caller, Veronica, at the top of the show, right, lamenting stagnation and bad attitude in Washington. And I mentioned Senator Jim Bunning. Here's a quick refresher in case you missed this. He's a Kentucky Republican, and he became quite the center of attention this week when he single-handedly put a hold on a bill to extend unemployment insurance for out-of-work Americans. And he actually held up the bill long enough for about 100,000 people to have their unemployment benefits interrupted. He then made things even better by just generally acting like a cranky old coot, swearing on the Senate floor, and flipping off a network TV reporter with a Twitter account. Good job. That's a long way of saying Senator Jim Bunning is the man of the week. And on In the Loop, that'll often as not get you your own song.
I can't move and I can't speak. Palms are sweaty, knees are weak. I'm caught up. I don't know where to start. Like the world's standing still, I'm a slave to his will. Yeah, Jim Bunning has placed a hold on my heart. If you can't understand how the strength of one man could make all your plans fall apart, it's a quirk of the game, and now it has a name. Yes, Jim Bunning has placed a hold on my heart. All of us as children saw just how a bill becomes a law. Ain't easy, I suppose that's for the best. Funny, there's a rule they get to make it even harder yet, and Bunnings got a thing for me, I guess. It's a funny kind of love when somebody cares enough to decide that you can't play your part. I'm enthralled to his whim, we are all waiting on him. Yes, Jim Bunnings placed a hold on my heart. He said a nasty word, then he flipped me the bird.
Nice.
Yeah, Jim Bunnings placed a hold on my heart.
Yeah, song a week, plus putting the video together. Won't kill me to take a little break from that. But they sure are fun. I'm going to miss them. The video, if you want to take a look at it, is at loopfacebook.net, our Facebook page. For Bunnings' part, he cast this as a symbolic stand for fiscal discipline. He's not running for re-election, so he can do that kind of thing, I guess. But I'm kind of getting the feeling it didn't really work. And you know me, I'm always thinking about the federal finances. And I was reading the other day about this idea for a securities transaction tax. Have you heard of this thing? We need money. This would get us about $150 billion a year. It also has some attractive psychic benefits, if you consider revenge to be an attractive psychic benefit. And it seems to be really gaining traction. So we called up Farron Williams to see if he'd be up for talking about it. Farron, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. How about yourself?
I'm doing great today. And Farron, if you don't recall, is our news niche who's way into personal finance news. He also, by day, writes software for weapons systems on Navy submarines, which sounds like just about the niftiest day job of anybody that we know. Let's see, in the House of Representatives, this bill is called the Let Wall Street Pay for the Restoration of Main Street Act. What do you make of that name, Farron?
Right now, you have a government that needs revenue. You have people who want to, quote-unquote, punish the people responsible for what the last time we talked, we were in the middle of a huge Wall Street crash. Banking system was failing, and there's still a desire on a lot of people's parts, probably including mine, to get back at the people who put us in that situation.
Why don't we start with just how this thing would work?
Okay. What this act would do is it would have a tax of 0.25% on all stock and derivative trades. So you go to the trade stock, and 0.25% of that value would be taken in tax.
So that sounds pretty tiny, but let's think about the people who would be most slammed by this and actually who are supposed to be most slammed by it.
Yeah. There are a lot of people who do a lot of day trading. They basically go in and out of stocks multiple times a day, and they count on making pennies per trade, basically, and that's how they make their money.
They're not in it for the long haul. They're not necessarily looking at the, whether a company is going to do well over months or years. They're looking at what's the margin they can get on this momentary trade. And in some cases, these trades are executed, in like microseconds?
Yeah, they make very small amounts on it, but by trading hundreds of times a day, thousands of times a day across multiple stocks, they're able to make a living off it.
Right, and the argument is that these day traders and also, I guess, big investment bank players who have these architectures set up to just do zillions of these trades, right, that they're somehow damaging the system, and this is meant to just slow things down.
In theory, it will slow things down. I mean, there will be probably less trades going on. Supposedly, mutual fund companies trading in IRAs would be exempt from it, and people trading the first $100,000 for the year would be exempt from it.
So that represents the little guy, right?
Or
is meant to, anyway, the common investor. What's the political landscape for this thing? I know the unions are big in favor of it, and that was news this week, and the president has talked about potentially supporting it. How are people lining up on each side?
It's pretty predictable. I mean, Wall Street is dead set against it. Businesses who are advisors for people's finances are against it because, if nothing else, it drains money that they want to be taking. A lot of the unions, some of the small investor groups are for it, saying that the people who caused this were the people who were computer trading. A lot of these derivative transactions would also be taxed. People hear derivatives and they're saying, yes, those are the people who did this to us, and we want them taxed badly. But it really was more people on the bond side, people trading bond derivatives, mortgage derivatives, and this wouldn't touch any of that. That would be the issue I would have with it.
Hmm. Is this just a provocative idea that's getting a lot of buzz right now, or does it really have a chance in hell?
Actually, it's a little of both. We have a government right now that needs revenue. We're running a very big deficit, and $150 billion a year would help make up some of that deficit. So you've got people who want some additional spending and need a place to find revenue that won't directly affect individuals. You know, something that won't hurt them politically in theory.
So, could happen.
Could happen.
Huh. Well, Farron, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks for helping spell this out for us.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
You bet. That's Farron Williams talking with us from Manassas, Virginia. Now, we hate to let a week go by, and especially this close to the end, right? Without an appearance from our producer, Sandon Totten. And so he's here now. Sandon, welcome.
Hey, Jeff.
And you're here today with some speculations and musings that, in this case, I guess, not stimulated by anything particular from our audience or anything, just your own rambling pursuit of knowledge.
Yeah, rambling indeed. Well,
Can you tell I don't have a script?
You know, I don't know. The news has just been kind of depressing lately. I mean, first we had things like swine flu and, all these earthquakes. So I noticed something that was some good news, like the world was becoming less dangerous. And of course, I had to take notice in that. For the last 2 years, there's been a significant decrease in the number of shark attacks.
What? Shark attacks?
Yep.
Is that because of the corresponding increase in Shark Week programming that they now know we're keeping an eye on them?
No, actually, that's a good guess, though. Mm. But nope, it's the recession, or at least that's the theory of America's Shark Master General, George Burgess, who actually has been on the Shark Week shows a number of times. He's the director of the Florida Program of Shark Research at the University of Florida.
Wait, does he call himself the Shark Master General?
I made that up. Okay. But he should.
Yes, to save him some embarrassment.
Well, he's also the keeper of the International Shark Attack File. And so anyone who's in charge of the International Shark Attack File should have a pretty cool name, I think. But anyway, he says, yeah, it's probably the recession.
There's less money to go around for recreational sort of activities, vacations, and so forth. If there are, in fact, less humans going into the water over the last couple of years, then the opportunities for the two coming together, of course, are reduced. It's like buying one ticket or 1,000 tickets in the state lottery. The more tickets you have, the greater the chances.
Sure, except that I'd rather win the lottery than be bitten by a shark. But
Well, I'll tell you this. Being attacked by a shark is a very uncommon phenomenon.
Right. Do you think the sharks have any idea that they're experiencing recession up on the land? Just curious.
No, maybe they're getting less sandwiches thrown overboard by fishermen and things like that. Yeah. Anything other than that, I'm afraid you're giving much too much credit to their little brains.
I'll leave it to our tiny brains to suss out what other kinds of random things might have to do with the recession somehow. Okay, shark attacks, I guess. What else?
Well, okay, so there's actually like a burgeoning field of science around what we can blame the recession for.
Burgeoning?
Yeah. One of them, for instance, is that the recession might be making some people fatter.
I can sort of see that. People eat when they're depressed, I guess, but I would also think we have less money to spend on food.
Well, okay, here was the catch in the study.
Okay.
It depends on who you are. So if you started the recession a little overweight, which, of course, many Americans probably did, you're going to end up even more overweight because of the recession. But the good news is, if you were fit and trim when the recession started, you're likely to keep that weight level.
Hmm. Okay. If people haven't guessed yet, our theme for this segment is things affected by the recession that you wouldn't expect, and you've got a couple more.
Right. Okay, so the good news is we may be getting fatter, but past studies have shown that the death rate actually drops during periods of high unemployment. So check this. Mm. Christopher Rum, he's an economist at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, he found that for every 1% increase in the unemployment rate, on average, the death rate goes down 0.5%.
You might call him the Death Master General.
I would. But let's crunch some numbers here. I actually brought a giant calculator.
That is one big calculator.
Yeah, we can crunch some numbers right here. So at the start of the recession, December 2007, the unemployment was 4.8%.
Okay.
And today, latest numbers say that it is 10.6.
Oh.
Really 10.6 minus 4.8.
Okay.
Divided by 2. And 2.9%. The death rate has decreased 2.9%.
That is no small thing.
No, that's pretty awesome. And the reasoning behind this one is that as the recession starts in, people take less trips, so there's less deadly car accidents, and you can't buy money.
Shark attacks.
Right, there's less shark attacks. There's less money to spend on things like tobacco and alcohol, which might be off on you before your time.
Mm-hmm. And really expensive steaks.
Which clog your arteries and kill you. Mm-hmm. But tofu's pretty cheap. They also say that maybe when people don't have jobs, they're not going to be so stressed out. They have more time to go to the gym. They take care of themselves.
Is that how it works when you're unemployed? All right. I'm not like sure I buy that part.
Giant but. Day spa, maybe? No. Yeah. It's these are all theories, of course. Yeah, you know, this is correlative studies. So these scientists are trying to figure it out.
Yes. But history shows us that people die less
during high periods of unemployment. That's or at least Christopher Rum from University of North Carolina.
Deathmaster General. Okay. And you have another one here. And this one is for those of us who are not sitting at home on our couches feeling blissful, apparently. This is one for those of us who are in the office every day.
Right. Well, this one was done by a British TV station that for some reason is just called Dave. They did a survey.
Sounds
and they
very credible.
They found that office jargon is on the rise, and that actually there's like a big influx of recession-ready terms. I actually got a list here of some of the new terms they found. The study was done in England, so they're a little British. But I don't know, stuff like credit munch, switching to a cheaper lunch as a result of the recession.
Okay.
Or perhaps you took a job you didn't really want just to get by. They call those a CV stain, a job or a company that looks so terrible you'd rather leave it off your CV or resume.
Okay, I'll take a couple here. Instead of getting fired these days, I guess we're being uninstalled. maybe if you work for like an IT firm.
Downgraded or something.
And then the new term for layoffs, at least in Britain, is a decruitment.
I like this one. Google Zoo, when the entire staff are pretending to work but really just surfing the web. That's like our cube every day.
Yeah, this is okay. Here's a great recession one. Uptitling. I think I've heard this. Changing an employee's job title to something impressive and sometimes ridiculous sounding instead of giving an actual promotion.
That's like when you changed my title to Loopmaster General.
Very good.
Okay, so this one too. This one's a great one. Mushroom principle. Managers keeping the staff in the dark and feeding them crap.
Nice.
Basically what you do for mushrooms.
And this, okay, one more. This must be peculiarly British, but I kind of like it. A Chinese holiday. Taking a 5-minute break by pretending you need to go to the bathroom and then just sitting on the China-like toilet with your head in your hands.
Is that what we call it? Oh, I was just called it taking a potty break, but now I have the proper term.
Now we've managed to make it an insulting ethnic reference.
Right.
Apparently. And again, these are all British, but we have our own. Okay, I believe it. An increase in office jargon during the recession.
So one more thing we can blame on the recession.
Yeah. Now, I asked you when I knew you were thinking about this whether you had any theories of your own beyond your research. What do you got?
I do. And this one has actually irked me a lot. I have been noticing because of the recession, there's been an increase in beardiness. I feel like all around, because people can't afford to shave or whatever it is, men are growing beards. And in fact, I saw a discouraging study yesterday that said 41% of women thought that the unkempt, beardy look was attractive in men. And this frustrates me to no end because, hear that sound? Like a baby's bottom. I can't grow a beard. So as stylish as it gets, and women may like it, and it may be in vogue, I am praying that, you know, as the recession eases, this beard thing goes out fast and is never looked at again. Because in the beard category, I'm coming up a little short.
Well, in the meantime, during the recession, think of how much money you're saving on razors. There's always a silver lining.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Another fine investigation of many, many things by Sandin. All right. Have a good one, Sandin.
You too, Jeff.
Bye-bye. And now, Smarts, a little walk-in music, if you please, while I simulate my relocation to a slightly larger and somewhat different-sounding studio. We're walking. It's good walk-in music. So I hardly need to recap this for people who are listening to the podcast, I'm sure, but just for formality's sake, we've had a great time over the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks doing what we've called our starving artist interviews. People who, in the middle of the recession, jump into the arts and try to make their living at it. So we have a musician joining us in the studio today to kind of round out the set. This is Heather Lynn. Heather Lynn, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I first ran into Heather Lynn when I was emceeing a local conference related to sexual violence, I don't know, a month or two ago, right?
Mm-hmm. And I'd just like to add that it was about sexual violence prevention.
Prevention, yes. A very different kind of conference. I don't think I'd have accepted the invitation to MC that other one. But
I'm so glad to know that.
Then I ran into her, just coincidentally, at a house concert thing that we were both playing.
Exactly.
And I started talking to her, and it became very clear to me that this is not just something you're doing to kill time in the evenings.
Definitely not.
And just to satisfy some kind of creative bug that you have, although that certainly is the case.
It's part of it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But when was it that you decided to go full time and say, you know, I love it this much, I'm going to actually try to make a living being essentially a folk singer, right?
Essentially. It was a few years ago that I started to be unsettled and dissatisfied. And I think it's what some people call the quarter life crisis. And I was realizing, even though I had a lot of really great things going on in my life, good marriage, good job, I was just feeling sort of drained and depleted. And I have always had this dream to be a singer. And that's taken on this a different kind of form and vision throughout my whole life. But I've always wanted to be a singer. Mm-hmm. One of my dreams was to make an album or make a CD. And I realized I wanted to write more of my music instead of singing other people's music. I wanted to do my own. And I wanted to travel and not just do it in one place all the time.
Both you and your husband left your jobs.
That's
and
true.
He devoted himself to being your manager and you devoted yourself to the music.
Yes.
It sounds really romantic and to a lot of people probably
potentially
foolhardy.
Yes. So we took steps towards this. So first I just went part-time and then eventually knowing that I would have to quit my job and do this full-time because you can't be a traveling musician and be away for weeks at a time if you have another job. So there just came a moment where I couldn't stand it anymore. We'd made enough progress and enough contacts and I knew exactly what I would be doing if I was working at home on this, on the art, on touring, on booking, et cetera. I knew exactly what I'd be doing if I wasn't in at work on Monday. And even though I love my job and believed in it, I couldn't stay there anymore with integrity because I couldn't devote my whole heart and my whole mind to it anymore. And we didn't know how the bills were going to get paid. And there's a lot of stress and there's been a lot of tears about that at various points. But
is it less precarious now than it was at the beginning?
Isn't really less precarious, honestly, because it's still day to day and sometimes it's bill to bill. But nobody really sees behind the closed doors when I'm like bawling my eyes out because I'm hoping that we won't have to pay our bills by writing ourselves a check from our credit card, you know, things like that.
One of the things I thought was really interesting about your formula and that I really want to talk about with you is that it's not really, it seems, about selling CDs, right? You have a mission and you have sort of a purpose about you and you needed to be very purposeful about the types of venues and the types of gigs that would work for you.
That's true.
What are those?
Yes. This is like being self-employed, and it's like running a small business and taking those same kinds of risks and essentially building clientele just like any business would. So one would be faith communities, so churches and places like that, or interfaith stuff. Another would be nonprofit organizations. Other things are even corporate events. So anything that has to do with a diversity program or volunteerism or a benefit concert.
Well, this might be a good time to have you play a song for us.
Okay.
Let people hear you before we get too deep into this interview. This is Heather Lynn. And what's the name of the tune you're going to play?
I'm going to play Home With You. Since we're talking about recession, it kind of highlights what's most important.
Great. Go for it.
Shack. Cedar firewood piled up in the back, and plastic duct taped around the windows. Just hold me closer to stay warm in the winter drafts, 'cause I'd be at home. My home is with you wherever we are, wherever we are. And if we lived in a high and lofty mansion, interior designed in true high fashion,
Italian imported rugs. We'd take tea on plush velvet couches and sip from silver mugs. And I'd be at home with you, baby. Yeah, I'd be at home with you, my love. All I need to make this house stay home is for us to be together. My home is with you. So my husband particularly requested this verse. And if we lived in a conversion van RV, taking music on the road, the whole country to see. Ah, the glamorous life, sweating gigs, New Year's to December. Driving miles bundled in bunks with smelly band members. But I'd be at home with you, baby. Yeah, yeah, I'd be at home with you, my love. All I need to make this house stay home is for us to be together. My home is with you, wherever we are, wherever we are, wherever we are.
Well, of course you have a beautiful voice, without which none of this makes any sense, does it?
Oh,
you kind of need
you.
That to start with. And
I suppose
I've heard that song, I guess I heard it on your CD, and I heard you play it at that house concert we were at, and then I've heard this. And just something that I noticed, very savvy, you have lots of different verses you can plug into that song.
Correct.
Yeah, depending on the circumstance. I think it's been different each time I've heard it.
Yes, I think when we were at that house concert, it was the holiday time. Mm-hmm. It was December or January. So I did the Christmas version. And then often, if I'm in an audience where we can be really interactive, I make it a choose-your-own-adventure song. So I'm like, where do you guys want to go? Do you want to go to Ireland? Or do you want to go to the northern woods of Minnesota? Or do you want to head out on the road in the, or to a coffee shop?
Well, very smart. It's fun. Very smart to be adaptable, I guess.
I
mean, you know your audience and you can actually adapt the music on the fly to them, which is fun, but it's also,
really
as a business thing, it seems smart.
It provides more opportunities, for sure.
How has really going professional changed your music?
I don't think the music has changed at all since going professional or making this our full-time gig. Anything I write has to be true to who I am, or I'm going to feel vacant and I'm going to, like something inside me is going to die.
When I look at the pictures that are on your CD that I have and some of the older pictures of you, you look different than you do now and you know, when I met you a couple months ago.
Yes.
Now you've got kind of, I don't know, it's maybe sort of a Ani DiFranco thing going.
Oh, really?
I don't know. How would you describe it, but it's an image.
Because Ani DiFranco has dreads?
Sure.
Is that?
Well, yeah, that's an obvious comparison, right?
Right.
Did you adapt your image because it would help you maybe become more successful?
No, it wasn't a conscious thing at all. It was completely a, wow, I feel really free to do whatever I want right now.
I don't have to go to work, so I don't have to wash my hair. Because I quit my job.
Okay. And actually, the dreads thing is a relatively new idea. I have always thought they looked cool.
But it is more marketable. Because those old pictures of you, you know, the music is beautiful, but you look like any other Midwestern girl, I guess. And now you leave somebody with a particular impression.
Thank you for pointing that out, because I really haven't thought about it very much.
Wow. It works that way.
Cool.
So how old are you now?
I'm 29.
So you've leapt into this. I'm sure you hope to make it a lifelong thing.
Yes.
How do you imagine it in 20 years?
I hope that I'm still going strong. I hope that I'm still healthy and relevant and energetic and continuing to grow as an artist and reinvent myself as needed.
But what has to happen between now and then?
Well, I have to be far beyond the paying your dues stage, for one thing, which I hope will happen in the next year or two. So I hope to become more sustainable financially and getting way past the break-even point. That will hopefully happen in a couple years. And I also think that if there's a time that I'm not doing it, it will be my choice.
Well, let's do one more song. We'll end off the conversation and end off the show. This is Heather Lynn, and learn more about her at heatherlynnmusic.com.
I just want to clarify, too, Heather Lynn Music. Heather Lynn is spelled L-Y-N.
Yes.
With an L-Y-N, just one N.
Worth clarifying.
Yeah. I'm going to do When I Dream, just because it is, we're kind of talking about living a dream here, but sometimes living a dream isn't always so dreamy.
Well, thanks so much for coming in, and we'll let you take us out.
Cool.
When I dream, it's like TV screens are on the inside of my eyelids. But I don't have a remote to choose my shows or do TiVo. Seems my fears come alive no matter how hard I try. Deep in my soul, Lord, I know you'll never leave. Still I pray, please don't go. No matter how hard I try,
that was financially break even, more or less, folk singer Heather Lynn, following on the tale of, in reverse chronological order, the poet, the comedian, the printmaker, and the actor. That's our Starving Artist interview series, and it's been a great idea and well produced by Anna Wegel. I want to thank her for helping to make it happen. In the Loop is produced by Sandin Totten and me. We got some special help this week from Rob Byers, who engineered that session there at the end. Our theme and much of our other music is by The Smarts, and a lot of times I forget to credit them. It just kind of slips by. These three guys who wrote and performed all this instrumental stuff we use free of charge. A lot of those are vocal-free tracks from songs that they and I wrote for the show way back in the day. And The Smarts have been great contributors to In the Loop over the years, and they're friends of mine, and of course I'll see them again, but want to say thank you. Which leads to the final note here, as I promised, on the fact that In the Loop is going away. In some ways, really, the less said, the better. And I'm not going to eulogize it, really, because at the very least, you know, we have another show left. We have reinvented ourselves many times now. We have survived, and we have done, most importantly, we've done great work. Not like anything on public radio or anywhere else. But the opportunity for In the Loop to grow here at Minnesota Public Radio is exhausted. Time for new things. And while, of course, I had much bigger dreams for it, and I'm mourning it for sure, I'm ready to move on. I think for our last show, I'd like to do something with people's in-the-loop memories or favorite segments or something like that, you know, and there'll probably be some amount of actual show there too. But if you want to start feeding us ideas for that, you can go to our Facebook page, loopfacebook.net, and post away. I'll probably have a formal email out about it early next week, I suppose. And I'm going to end with a thank you to all of you, a few thousand, we gather, who listen to the podcast every week. You're it. You're the point. You found us. You got what we're doing. You told your friends about us. And that is why we're here. Okay, a little back-patting moment here, but I'm going to read something that a woman named Melissa, not somebody that I know or who I think we've ever heard from before, but she posted it on our Facebook page just 2 days ago. Here we go. I just had surgery, and during my recovery, I caught up on In the Loop podcasts. They made me not think about my pain. The only problem was when you made me laugh too often, and it felt like my stitches were going to come out. Just thought I'd say a little thank you for helping me get through this. Well, if we can walk away with something like that, that's pretty good. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I will talk to you at least one more time on In the Loop.